You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. British novelist Chris Cleave has always tackled contemporary themes in his three previous books. From his acclaimed debut, Incendiary, a story about a mother losing a child to terrorism, which was officially published on the day of the London bus bombings, to Little Bee, a story set against the contemporary plight of refugees and immigration, and Gold, released right before the London Olympics on the single-mindedness of world-class athletes and the consequences of that single pursuit. So it might come as a surprise to see that his latest effort is a foray into historical fiction. But his new book, Everyone Brave is Forgiven, set at the beginning of World War II, looks back at a time when the United Kingdom, like the United States, so bitterly divided today, was utterly united in a common task. And that was the beginning point for the book. Everyone Brave is Forgiven tells the story of three people, aristocrat Mary North, school administrator Tom Shaw, and art restorer turned soldier Alistair Heath. Three people from different classes, thrown together only by the chaos of warfare. Chris Cleave won the 2006 Somerset Maugham Award and has been shortlisted twice for the Commonwealth Writers Prize. Chris Cleave, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, this book, Everyone Brave is Forgiven, is set at the very beginning day of World War II, September 1st, 1939, as your character Mary immediately volunteers. She's a blue blood. And one of the things you said you wanted to focus on in writing this book was, given how divided times are in the UK and certainly here in the United States as well, you said you wanted to think back on an era where everyone was really united in a single cause.
Yeah, that's why I wrote the book. I think you have to go back, certainly in my country, the UK, you have to go back to the Second World War to find the last time that you can really say, yeah, that's the time when we managed somehow to put our differences aside and to come together in the cause of a common project. I do think it's an interesting journey to look at again with today's eyes, because we have the same problems, I think, that they did in the run-up to the war. You know, big social divisions. And these two sides of the argument, you have to imagine that there are decent people on both sides of the argument, but they just can't find a way of looking each other in the eye anymore. And I thought it was interesting to go back to the last time that that was the case and to investigate the journey of how they came together, you know, how they managed to set aside what separated them in the pursuit of, you know, defeating a greater evil.
And when we think of the UK, we think it was an existential threat. I mean, it was really the threat of being overrun.
Yeah, and in fact, we were being overrun until America came into the war in early 1942, from our point of view. We were losing. I make no mistake about it. You know, it was America who came in and saved us, you know, and saved Europe from fascism. Britain was holding out, but just, and the rest of Europe had already fallen. So it was an existential threat. And I think one of the things that Britain is enduringly grateful for to America is that America did decide to engage in the European war. Although it was Pearl Harbor was the cause that brought America in, America chose to attack on the Pacific front and the European front. And that was a decision that really changed the world. Because if it hadn't, you know, I'm sure I wouldn't be here speaking to you now.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was an existential threat to a whole way of life.
Now, in addition to wanting to write about this time where divisions were put aside for a common goal and purpose, you also had another reason for writing this book, and this was this amazing trove of letters from your family. And the characters in the novel are fictitious, but an inspiration for two of the characters at the heart of them are your own grandparents.
Yeah, the whole book came out of a conversation that I began with my grandfather about 10 years ago, my mum's father. He had been in Malta during the Second World War, so a small island in the Mediterranean, which was very strategically important, which the Allies held, and which the Axis powers of Germany and Italy encircled and besieged. And for a period of a couple of years, not only was the island starved out, but it was also incredibly heavily bombed. And so it was a very little-known area of the war. I didn't know anything about it until my grandfather, in his mid-80s, began finally to talk about what it had been like. And I was so blown away by how great their suffering had been and how much they had endured, that I began to investigate and to find out a little bit more about that theatre of the war. And slowly but surely, it sort of took over. It took over from the project I was working on at the time. I became more and more interested in just the scale of the achievement of that generation, you know, how brave they became. And because he was my grandfather, I know him as someone who wasn't just a hero. You know, he didn't spring fully formed as this sort of square-jawed, stoical man who could endure anything. I knew him from his early letters to my grandmother that have been preserved in the family. I knew him as this person who started out, I guess, just like us, you know, someone who hadn't been tested to that degree, and he started out scared. And what fascinated me was his journey into bravery, you know, to realize that people aren't born brave, but that courage is a muscle that develops through use. And so I began to look at how he had become this person who could fight a war. And by extension, I looked at that whole generation in America and in Britain, on the front line and on the home front. You know, how did they do it? Because I think the question of how they did it is just as interesting as an acknowledgement of what they achieved.
What was the discovery as you began investigating the how?
The first thing I noticed was how deep their characters were. So I grew up on war movies and novels about the war, which portray the people who fought it as these people who were already, you know, very brave. They made wisecracks. They were strong. They were old. In the war movies, the actors who play those characters are 10, 15, sometimes 20 years older than the young men and women who actually fought that war. And I guess what I discovered as I researched was people who were a lot younger, a lot scarier, a lot deeper in character, and often a lot funnier than the way they're portrayed in the movies that I'd grown up on. And I began to see that generation in a whole new light, to see them as much less heroic and much more human, which paradoxically made me respect what they had achieved even more.
Now, in your book, the very first pages of the novel, we meet Mary North, who is sounds like she's finishing school on the continent, and she immediately comes home and volunteers for the war effort because she's an aristocrat. And not something we'd expect an aristocrat to do, and immediately launches herself into this war effort. Why start that way?
I was interested in how the war changed everything for all social classes. So in the UK and in America, it was hugely disruptive of the lives that people had mapped out for themselves. So in the UK, we had this class system. You were born into it, and that was the life you were going to live. So it's interesting at the beginning of the novel to take Mary, who has life lined up for her on silver rails, really. I mean, she's going to go to finishing school, then she's going to marry some eminently suitable young man and go to live a fairly decadent life in the British aristocracy. Whereas in fact what happens is that the war is declared pretty much on the first day of her adult life, and she has to make a choice. Is she going to try to avoid it, or is she going to get involved? And that was a choice that, you know, split the country down the middle, really. Half of the people got stuck in straight away, and half of the people thought, oh, maybe we'll sit this one out. Well, she decides to get stuck in, and that changes everything. That means that she becomes a teacher. That's the war work that she's assigned to. And it's absolutely not what she was expecting to do with her life. As a result, she meets people that she would never otherwise have met. You know, she meets what that class of people would think of as, you know, the common man and woman, who they would never normally mix with. And yet then she does, and she develops these real human connections with the pupils that she teaches. So it's utterly transformative of her life.
At her first school, she's there to supervise the disbursement of children to the country. Her headmistress basically says, you're a blue blood, you're not cut out to be a teacher. Basically get out. But she finally meets another administrator, Tom, who becomes the love interest at the first part of the novel. And his flatmate is Alistair Heath, who is an art restorer at the Tate. But unlike Tom, he volunteers just like Mary. And what's really interesting about these two characters, I thought, was they have a great passion for the underdog.
Yes, and I think that comes from a sense of responsibility. I think something that redeems Mary, even though she starts out as this very, as you say, blue-blooded character, and something that redeems Alistair is that they begin to realize how much privilege they have and how much they owe to the society that's given that to them. I think there's also a sense where they both realize that their lives are built on the shoulders of so many other people. And to give a concrete example, Alistair's job, as you say, he's an art restorer. He works at the Tate Gallery in London. Now, at the beginning of the war, and this really happened, they take all of the pictures down off the walls of that gallery. They box them up in wooden packing crates, and they send them on trucks to Wales, and you know, to the west of Britain, and they put them down coal mines to protect them from any bombing. So you end up with this gallery that's completely empty, which is this rather beautiful symbol of what Alistair's job has become. You know, he's the curator of nothing anymore. And it's very hard for him to say, actually, it's important for me to stay on in my job. He realizes that there's a bigger fight, there's a bigger thing to curate, there's a bigger thing to protect, which is the whole way of life that produced all of that art. And that way of life includes a lot of people that he wouldn't normally have mixed with. And there begins his journey too, from a very refined kind of life into a life that's actually bigger and warmer and more real than the life he would have had without the war.
The novel's not necessarily about class. What's interesting about both of these characters is they belie the stereotypes of class, even when they're surrounded by manifestations of those stereotypes of class.
Yeah, and I think that's people, really. I mean, The class system in Britain has always been a really sad and difficult thing because it does separate people. And actually, when you meet people from all different classes, you realize that, you know, there's an absolute equivalence of intelligence. There's an absolute equivalence of motivation. You know, people are the same. And I like to break down that perception that the aristocracy is all quite is vacuous, or that the lower orders are slovenly. You know, I think those are both equally untrue. And I like to get to the heart of people and the way their characters respond to actually being tested by real things happening to them.
You mentioned some of the research you went into in writing Everyone Brave is Forgiven. One of the things you did was you went to Malta.
That also came out of a conversation with my grandfather. So he talked about all of the places that he was stationed on that island. And one of the great things that we have now is, you know, we have Google Earth, and you can look down with your grandparent at the place that they were stationed, at the place that they served. And because my grandfather was in artillery, that leaves a real signature on the earth. You can see from space these concrete emplacements that they poured to mount their artillery pieces on. So I could say, oh yeah, that place in your memoir, in your memory, corresponds exactly to these coordinates on the ground. And then I could get a ticket to Malta and I could actually go to that place. And you would sometimes have to cut through, you know, some brambles and undergrowth, but you could get to the exact place. So I was able to find all of these places where my grandfather had been stationed, these very remote places during the war. And I spent some time there, and I think that's always been my deal as a writer, that I try to walk a little bit in my character's shoes, and I won't write about a place unless I've spent quite a lot of time there and let the place kind of soak into me a little bit.
Now, your last novel, Gold, it was about two bicycle racers. You took up bicycle racing. What did you learn from having your feet on the ground in Malta that helped tell the story better?
I learned that I was better at standing with my feet on the ground in Malta than I was at bicycle racing.
I believe there was an accident involved in the bicycling, wasn't there?
Yeah, it turns out I'm not a great bicycle racer. But the Malta research was altogether more serious and more rewarding in a strange way. So taken for granted that I'm researching a very sad subject, which is the Second World War, I was always looking for the human stories within it, the things that had made people capable of enduring. And when I was interviewing people on the island of Malta, in search of those stories, something really I found very moving. You know, what you're always looking for as the novelist is reasons to live. You know, why do we do this? Why do we endure this project of life? Why don't people give up, given that the odds are stacked against us, even in peacetime, you know, as quiet, law-abiding, hopefully loving people? You know, why do we persist? And what I loved about Malta was there were so many stories from the people who had lived through that war, or the people who'd been kids while the siege was on, of these amazing ways that they had got through it. So the religious community there had prayed their way through it. The young kids on the island had treated the whole thing as a game and a period of wild freedom, you know, where school was out and all rules were suspended, and they used this whole field of rubble that their cities had become as the most enormous playground. Or if you looked at the people who'd been organizing the military logistics, just the very inspiring ways that they managed to continue to feed this population that was on the brink of starvation because of, you know, no supplies could get to the island. How people came together was amazing. You know, they didn't allow people to grow their own food for their own purposes. They made everyone on the island who could grow a crop put it into a collective ration, and they made it into soups and stews and redistributed it equally to everybody on the island. And it was an amazing example of how a group of human beings can pull together under such adversity. I think that's what I really learned on the island, is that, you know, however bleak it looks, there's a really good chance that the human beings involved will become stronger through that experience rather than weaker. And that whole island of Malta was a testament to, you know, what we can achieve as human beings if we're honest with each other, and if we think that the struggle is worth enduring. You know, that, I think that's what I got out of it.
My guest today is novelist Chris Cleave. His latest book is titled Everyone Brave is Forgiven. It's a New York Times bestseller. It's now out in softcover by Simon & Schuster. One of the things you enjoy, and it's come out in several other of your books, is the epistolary form to help tell the story. And while this is not a novel of letters, and you mentioned the influence of letters in beginning the book, letters do play a role in sort of shedding light in the story. What is it about a letter put into a novel that helps tell a story better?
I think letters are this amazing expression of the soul, really. That's the deepest part of you that you'll write to someone. I mean, in my life, very rarely have opportunities to write a letter now. I think we do it less and less. And I liked the way that people in the 1940s, you know, had to write these long letters to each other when they were separated by the war. They could still be together through this quite low frequency but really high intensity form of communication, which was the opposite, really, to what we have now. We have these wonderful networks. You know, I think Twitter is great. I think Facebook is great.
Skype.
Email. But what it is, you know, 40 times a day you connect with someone, but at this really low intensity. And I think what I miss is the passion, is the fire of that communication where you're risking more, you're putting yourself out there more, you're really pouring your heart out into a letter. And I think that's powerful in a novel because it reminds us of how big people are, you know, how much is contained in our experience and our hearts, how different we are from one another. And what a beautiful thing it is to love someone, to fall in love with someone, to communicate with that person, you know, from the depths of who you are. And that's what a letter is.
Well, the characters, as they find each other, what I really love is some of the dialogue in this book. I'm thinking of an incident very early in the novel where Alistair is in his basic training, and he's sort of the old man of the outfit in his early 20s. And there's one man that's a little older, this stage actor who actually loses his stutter only when on stage. that was a lovely little touch.
Yeah, I liked him, and he. I think Alistair asks him why. why he wants to be a soldier, and he replies that he was tired of playing the second murderer and wanted to play the first. I like that. I like the way the war brought together these people whose, you know, that wasn't their first idea of a job, you know, was serving in the military. But given that it was only their second choice, I loved looking at that process by which they left behind their civilian selves and toughened up, but without losing their character, without losing the things that made them charming. You know, when you look at a unit of people in the military, and gosh, I interviewed a bunch of veterans of that and a lot of other conflicts, you realize that, yes, there's the discipline, but also there's this real bond between people in an active unit. You know, they like each other for their characters, and they will do these brave things, yes, to follow orders, but much more to protect each other. And the reason they'll protect each other is because they like each other, and the reason they like each other is because their characters haven't disappeared just because they submit to military discipline. You know, they're still full human beings. I liked that in examining, you know, these military units. I liked the fact that people remain themselves, even though they've changed the purpose of their life.
Well, I think also it's that sort of common bond against the military mindset. A lot of times for citizen armies, I know that seems to be the thing that draws a lot of those, that camaraderie together. You may not necessarily like the guy from day to day, but you have this bond that's far greater.
Yeah, you do. You have a common enemy and you have a common oppressor. You know, the oppressor tends to be your own army, and the enemy is, you know, the person that your army is fighting against, and both of them unite you, and both of them, you know, give you common cause. Yeah, I completely agree. It's well put.
I guess you did quite a bit of research on just what life was like in the home front. There's, again, as I was mentioning, these characters fall for the underdog in many ways. This actor character that Alistair meets, he becomes the butt of the sergeant major, and he stands up for him in a belated way. For Mary, it's the treatment of a young, actually it's an African-American child, who, son of an entertainer in England, who is encountering prejudice. And this was an interesting note in the novel. Why this character of Zachary, a young boy, not very well learned, but Mary takes an affection to him as a student and as a person.
Yeah, and this is something that I discovered from my research. You know, again, a true story that the novel draws inspiration from. I discovered that there were 10,000 black families living in London at the outbreak of the war, which most British people don't know. And
they think of the influx of African or from the Commonwealth coming in after the war, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, most people think that began in 1948. There was a ship that docked called the Empire Windrush with the first batch of immigrants from the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And actually, there was already a big, important, productive, and thriving black British community in London at the beginning of the war. And I discovered this quite by accident when I looked at photos of London in the late 1930s and realized how many of these children there were in London schools and how few of them were evacuated from London at the outbreak of war. You know, most of London's children were sent away from London because they knew that there would be sustained aerial bombing. But a lot of these black children weren't evacuated. And I just became very curious as a researcher, like, why was that? And when I started asking around and interviewing people, well, the answer is that, unfortunately, some of these children experienced such a degree of racial prejudice when they left the confines of the metropolis and went out into the countryside. They just weren't welcome, and a lot of them basically had to come back. And that's a story that I don't think has been told about the Second World War in Britain. So I thought it was important, having discovered that, to keep it in the novel. You know, I realized that actually, now that I had found that out, it would be a conscious choice and a wrong conscious choice to leave it out of the novel. And so that's where the character of Zachary comes from. He is one of the children in Mary's class. He's one of the children that London is hosting during this tremendous aerial bombardment. You know, he's not evacuated, and his story is actually very common. I wanted to put that in because I like to make my stories as realist as possible. I like to look at London in the war, in this case, in all of its complexity. And here, therefore, are two characters who would never have been brought together without the war. This is the very aristocratic and blue-blooded Mary, who meets Zachary, who's from a world completely different from her own, but they meet as intellectual equals. And they meet in this context where she can do a lot for him and he can do a lot for her. And they form a friendship, which is also an alliance, where, in a way, they save each other on multiple occasions during that war. And I, you know, as we've discussed throughout this project, was looking to find examples of this human bond that brings us together across these social divides. And that was one that I stumbled across and felt was a really strong example of how we can come together despite the way society says we ought to be.
Now, there have been a number of books and films and the like that have shown that divide between the kids coming from the city to the country, but not that whole rejection of the kids coming because of difference. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, we tend to have this sort of rose-tinted memory of London during the war. I think some of it's justified. Winston Churchill called that period, you know, our finest hour. I think that's legitimate in many ways. That generation was extraordinary, and they were heroic, and they were extremely brave. But I think because of that, we gloss over a lot of stuff that was imperfect about Britain's social structure in the 30s and 40s. And I think we gloss over that at our peril, because that makes us blind to the situation we're in now, which is still imperfect. There's still a lot of work to do in bridging divides of class, of race, of ethnicity, of religion. And I think, you know, when you become a little too nostalgic, a little too sort of sepia-toned about the history of your country, you become blind to the present of your country as well. And that, for me, was a big motivation for writing this book.
Chris Cleave, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
English novelist Chris Cleave's latest book is titled Everyone Brave is Forgiven. It's published in softcover by Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.